Hi, I'm Carmen LaBurge. Thanks for listening to the podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge.
Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm just in.
Good morning. Indeed, today is the day. It's the day that the Lord has made. We are going to rejoice and be glad in it. I am Carmen LaBurge. Welcome to Mornings with Carmen. Wow, we've got a packed show today. Let me just give you a little preview. We're going to lead off with a conversation about Venezuela and not just the situation there, but how far we imagine Maduro might go to stay in power. We're going to talk about new U.S. sanctions. We're going to talk about some of the faith angles of the story, what we're hearing from people of faith in Venezuela. We're then going to turn our attention to the conversations that the president of the United States is having with North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un. And we're going to talk about what we might expect to happen out of that and how we might pray for a real peace. We're going to talk about all of those things with Drew Griffin from Providence Magazine and the Philos Project. And that is up first here this morning on Mornings with Carmen. Let me lead off with this, a word of encouragement for each of us and all of us today. The Lord is good. His steadfast love is new this morning. And so if you got up this morning and you're weary, you got up this morning and you are discouraged, you got up this morning and you are full of anxiety or fretful about something that lies ahead today or in the future, or something that feels like it's not done and you don't know how you're going to find the time or the resources to get it done, let me encourage you today that we have not only the knowledge of, but a living relationship with the God of all time and history and space and resources, and He loves you. He sees you. He knows your need. He is desiring to pour out His resources to meet those needs. And that's not a health and wealth gospel. That's the reality of God's character as a Father who is good. And so turn to the good Father this morning with your needs. Approach Him with humility. Acknowledge that His grace is all sufficient to meet whatever need it is that you are facing right now and in this day. All right, friends, you are listening to Mornings with Carmen. I am Carmen LaBurge, and next up, Drew Griffin on, well, pretty much all things international politics. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Mornings with Carmen. I am joined now by Drew Griffin from Providence Magazine and the Philos Project. Drew, welcome back to Mornings with Carmen.
Hey, good morning, Carmen. How are you?
Well, I'm well. I'm well. I hope you're well today. Let's start off by turning our attention to Venezuela. You guys actually have a couple of articles posted at providencemag.com about Venezuela. I'd like to lead off with the one, a conversation about people of faith in Venezuela in the midst of this crisis. We have talked about several angles of the Venezuelan story here on Mornings with Carmen. And so I'd appreciate it if you would give us a little bit of the faith angle today. What are you hearing from people of faith in Venezuela?
Right. So Venezuela is, you know, experiencing a real crisis. It's a humanitarian crisis. It's a political crisis. It's international now, a diplomatic crisis. And so people of faith of all stripes within Venezuela are, I think, trying to just basically survive these various crises. So 20 years ago, Venezuela experienced a revolution led by Hugo Chavez, and Chavez took over the government. And over the last 20 years, initially, due to their vast kind of oil resources, Venezuela experienced a massive kind of boom and economic boom, but due to a lot of corruption and a lot of graft, mainly on the part of Hugo Chavez and the military leaders that he installed and kind of paid throughout the country. Corruption kind of abounded, and so over the last 20 years, by the time we get to the last 2 or 3 years that since Nicolas Maduro, Chavez's hand-picked successor, took power, the country has basically collapsed into an almost failed state. They had hyperinflation, which is you know, what happens when basically the currency is reduced to paper. I mean, there's just, it costs literally millions of dollars to purchase like loaves of bread, that type of hyperinflation. And it's led to a major humanitarian crisis where people are starving. 3 to 4 million people have fled the country. And so you have Juan Guaido, who is the leader of the House there, who is basically said that he is the country's legitimate leader. And so there's now this kind of power struggle between Nicolas Maduro and Juan Guaido. And so the United States and most of the nations of the world and most of the nations in Latin America are supporting Juan Guaido against Nicolas Maduro and attempting basically to leverage all the instruments of international aid, humanitarian aid in Guaido's favor in order to try and pressure Maduro to step down. And the problem, though, is, of course, that Maduro is a power-hungry authoritarian dictator who has isolated himself and has no interest in stepping down, even if it were to benefit his people. And so there, what you have is people of faith and people of all belief systems are caught in this crisis and caught in the middle and are suffering as a result.
So, Drew, I think that you used a word in there that I think we should unpack and settle in on, and that is the word authoritarian. What?
Right.
Because that word gets thrown around in other conversations as well to describe other people. What, when you use that term, what are we talking about? I mean, what do we really mean when we say somebody is an authoritarian dictator?
Sure. Well, I mean, what we're talking about there is someone who is basically bent on perpetuating their own power and their own authority at the expense of others and at the expense of even legitimate democratic processes, at the expense of freedom of their own people, and oftentimes at the expense of the flourishing of their own country. And so you've got you see this throughout all of history. You see this throughout basically all across the world. You have countries like Libya with Muammar Gaddafi. You had Iraq with Saddam Hussein. You've got North Korea with Kim Jong-un, that these leaders come to power and their main goal is the perpetuation of their own regime and the filling of their own coffers, and they will do so at the expense of their own nations. And perpetuating that authority is the only thing really that matters. So they isolate themselves. They create structures that ensure their own flourishing at the expense of their own people. And they're willing to do anything, including use violence and oppression to kind of continue that regime. So Jorge Ramos, who is a journalist with Univision, was interviewing Nicolas Maduro recently and made some news himself in that Maduro had him detained following the interview because Ramos had the, you know, a temerity to ask this leader, this dictator, this authoritarian to challenge him and say that he was, in fact, a dictator, that he was, in fact, a despot. And Maduro didn't like this. You know, he didn't like this criticism. And so he actually had Ramos detained and actually ejected him from Venezuela, from his country, just because Ramos had the temerity to ask these you know, probing questions and to challenge the kind of the great leader. And so Ramos then has reported that Maduro has isolated himself so much that he's not even aware of the humanitarian crisis that is going on in his own country. He thinks everything is fine. He thinks everything is great, mainly because he is in power. And so that's typically what you see is these are people who are megalomaniacs. They are consumed with their own personality and the perpetuation of that personality, and typically don't accept any reality that can challenge their own perceptions of their greatness. And often they lead their country into total disarray in order to just mainly maintain their own power and authority. So that's kind of what we're talking about. That's what we're seeing in Venezuela. Honestly, that's what we see in North Korea. So it's a
that's a good segue to that conversation.
Fallen mankind, yeah.
So Drew Griffin from Providence Magazine and the Philos Project, he and I are going to continue this conversation. We're going to transition from Venezuela to North Korea. We'll be right back here on Mornings with Carmen. Welcome back to Mornings with Carmen. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. You know, because I feel like it's part of my responsibility to keep you up to date on what's happening around the world, how the mind of Christ comes to bear not only on the affairs of the heart and the affairs here in the United States, but foreign affairs as well. We enjoy having conversations with guys like Drew Griffin from Providence Magazine. And so, Drew, we're having a conversation very publicly on the international stage today. The president of the United States having a second summit with the leader of North Korea, notably one of only, five honestly communist countries left in the world. And in the midst of that, we're having conversations about nuclear war, nuclear warheads, denuclearization. And in the midst of all that, we got Pakistan and India actively shooting at each other. So give us a little give us a sense of maybe what your hopes are for this North Korea sit down. What are the prospects for real peace?
Well, I have to say, our hopes are not very high. I think what we see is a game that's being played on the international stage. And the problem is that I think in the past, the United States has sought through its policies and through its diplomacy to set the rules of that game and to set the terms of that debate. And I think, unfortunately, what I read is what's happening in North Korea right now and with this current kind of peace initiative is that North Korea seems to be succeeding in manipulating, I think, the United States in trying to accomplish what North Korea wants to accomplish. North Korea wants to maintain its own nuclear development. It wants to continue to grow its nuclear potential and its ability to protect itself and defend itself. It wants to see the United States' presence in South Korea and Asia reduced. And so I think, what we've seen over the last 20 years of constant kind of statements of, yes, we will reduce our program. Yes, we will denuclearize. Yes, we will try and shape up the way that we, treat our own people in a humanitarian kind of way. North Korea makes many promises and has made many promises over the years, has signed many statements, has agreed to many conditions, but has never, to this point, ever followed through with any of them. It has always been discovered in the backside to be disingenuous, mainly because they have other goals than the world community and other goals than the United States. And so I think what I find slightly troubling is not necessarily that President Trump is meeting with Kim Jong-un. Fine, meet, you met before, that's great. But what is the ultimate outcome here that is that we're seeking? And it has to be not only the denuclearization of North Korea, but it has to be the a change in the way that North Korea treats its own citizens, and a condemnation against the abuses, the human rights abuses that Kim Jong-un perpetrates against his own people and his own family. And so the problem that, that we have here when we look at the way rhetorically, at least, that the president seems to address Kim Jong-un and is approaching this peace initiative is that, you know, he calls Kim Jong-un a great leader, that there's a great future for his country. You know, these are things that might ease the moment and the short-term outcome of a meeting. But ultimately, I think they hurt the United States' moral credibility in that Kim Jong-un is a murderer. He is a tyrant. He's an authoritarian. His people are starving. His country is backwards. And he has murdered his own family members in order to stay in power. I mean, this is not someone who in any way could be called a great leader. And the United States, I think, is through President Trump's diplomacy, is ultimately hurting our long-term goals of peace, our long-term goals of human rights and liberty. I think by engaging in this kind of weird diplomacy that Trump seems to be engaging in, that's often, I think, unnecessarily flattering to this kind of world leader.
So, Drew, I'm kind of an eternal optimist, so I'm probably holding out greater hope, even for a process that might be flawed, because what we've done to this point simply hasn't worked. And so, you know, I guess I might have more hope for at least a formal end to the Korean War. I think there's a lot of people that, you know, they don't even know that technically the Korean War is not over. So, I mean, if we could move in the direction of a formal end to the Korean War, and then set up, you know, how maybe some multinational peace treaties might follow that, if we could imagine some kind of Mr. Gorbachev tear down that wall moment like we all experienced between East and West Germany, I think it would be, you know, it would certainly be different. But, you know, I mean, I guess I imagine that the president has that kind of hope, that he maybe has the kind of hope that there could be a very different kind of way forward than we have imagined. And at this point, we can't get in there to help people. And so, you know, at some point, we got to find a new way forward. And so I'm in no way discrediting anything that you have offered or brought to the table. I'd love to talk about Vietnam, because I think it's significant that they're meeting in Vietnam. I think that there's a lot of Americans who don't know that, you know, Vietnam was not America's first choice for this meeting. It's Kim's choice for the meeting. And I'm kind of wondering, you know, when he sees Vietnam, is he thinking to himself, hey, you know, here's what real economic flourishing looks like when capitalism is embraced? Or does he see, you know, hey, here's a one party socialist government that not only prevailed in war against its southern citizens, but is now thriving, having fought long and hard against efforts by the world, including America, to push it toward democracy? I mean, Vietnam is a communist country, right?
Mm. Yes, no, it is. And I think it again, in terms of this kind of chess match, in terms of this game that is being played, I think North Korea is definitely in the driver's seat. I mean, North Korea is the one right now, I think, that's trying to set the terms. And I don't think it's an accident that they're pointing to a state that was heavily subsidized by China, a communist state that has experienced some economic vitality, and also a state that had had a longstanding, you know, obviously we fought a war against it, and there was an acrimony there with the United States. And yet, you know, now there's some kind of rapprochement and peace between the two countries. I don't think it's an accident that he chose it, and that there's a message that's being sent there. I mean, but again, what the ultimate goal of North Korea is the reduction of the U.S. presence in Asia and in South Korea. And they would love to see the war end, and an armistice followed by like a peace treaty between the United States and North Korea. But the problem with that is it's not so that North Korea can, in Kim's mind, flourish and become a grand bastion of freedom. It's so North Korea can develop it and continue its own authoritarian regime unfettered and unchecked by the world community in the United States. So, yeah, they want peace. Yeah, they want, kind of to be left alone. But I don't think anyone could possibly argue that Kim has the best interest of his people in his mind, because if he did so, he would have policies in place now that would flourish. There's nothing stopping Kim from, as an authoritarian leader and a dictator who has complete and total control of his country, from instituting any policy he wants to see his country flourish, to establish relations with other nations, to call for elections or do whatever he needs to change his nation. And yet he is content to remain in power at the expense of his own people, and to do so as many other authoritarians have. So, yeah, I think they want peace, but I think it's important that they accept peace and the conditions of peace that are offered by the world community and by nations that have proven themselves to be defenders of freedom and democracy, like the United States.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, Drew, thank you so much for being with us today on Mornings with Carmen. That's Drew Griffin from Providence Magazine. You can check out what they're doing at providencemag.com, pretty sure. All right, friends, this is Carmen LaBurge. I got to take a quick break, and we're going to lighten it up. Hey, welcome back to Mornings with Carmen. I am your host, Carmen LaBurge. I want to alert you to what's going on in the world that you may not be aware of yet. It does appear as if India and Pakistan are actively engaging one another in what could be the precursor to war. And trending on Twitter globally, the top 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the top 5 trending issues are all related to this now live fire exchange between India and Pakistan. So let's be praying on that front. Let's pray the news this morning on that front, even as we turn our attention to more local concerns and issues. You're listening to Mornings with Carmen. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. Welcome back to Mornings with Carmen. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. Thank you for taking us along on the ride this morning, wherever you're going. So a couple of weeks ago, Julie Lohse was with us to talk about the Collegiate Day of Prayer. The Collegiate Day of Prayer is now upon us. It is tomorrow nationwide here in the United States. You can go to collegiatedayofprayer.org to find a campus near you where you can be praying. Here are some comments that Julie made about the Collegiate Day of Prayer.
The Collegiate Day of Prayer actually has a really cool history. It's about a 200-year-old event that happened for about 100 years and then just kind of stopped. And about 7 or 8 years ago, a group of men, very godly men and concerned about what's going on campus, said, you know what, maybe we should look at reinstating the Collegiate Day of Prayer. And these were days of prayer actually led by the church, encouraged by the church to come together and pray for college campuses and college students. Because at the time, back in the 1700s and 1800s, those students were going to go on and be the evangelical leaders of the church. So the church had a very vested interest in their college students, and the church actually started most of our higher, education institutions.
So, friends, there are 2,520 campuses that need someone to pray for them tomorrow on the Multi-Generational Collegiate Day of Prayer for Revival and Awakening on College Campuses in America. So I'm inviting you to go to collegiatedayofprayer.org and find a campus that needs somebody to be praying for it and sign up to be that person. Adopt a campus at collegiatedayofprayer.org. You're listening to Mornings with Carmen. I'm Carmen LaBurge. We'll be right back.
We are created in the image of God, but in what way are we made in His image? This is Jim Garlow. For starters, God creates, and He has given us creativity in our daily work. And as we create, we become partners with God. Maybe it's a product, or conveying information, or meeting a need. All function in an occupation that gives opportunity for a vocation, which means whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. That's the definition of vocation. Quaker philosopher Elton Trueblood said, secular work, well done, is holy enterprise. I agree. But when we fail to live out the purpose for which we were created, we get frustrated. Show me a person who does his or her job only for money, and they will be profoundly unfulfilled. Why? Because they have missed the reason for their occupation. That is to live out their vocation. That is doing all for the glory of God. There's more at jimgarlow.com.
If I should speak, then let it be of the grace that is greater than all my sin.
Welcome back to Mornings with Carmen. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. I'm joined now by Jeremy Dice. He is the Deputy General Counsel for First Liberty. He's also host of the First Liberty Briefing. Jeremy, welcome to Mornings with Carmen.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a joy to have you on with us today. So, you know, I'm a little troubled that our news headlines are, you know, so jam-packed with salacious headlines that there's a lot of folks who don't know that oral arguments are happening in the Bladensburg Memorial Cross case today at the Supreme Court. So remind us what the Bladensburg Memorial Cross case is about, and then tell us what's happening today.
Well, the Bladensburg Memorial is the Bladensburg World War I Veterans Memorial, and it stands outside of Washington, D.C. in Prince George's County, Maryland. And in 1919, mothers who had lost their sons to World War I decided to borrow from the gravestones of their sons in Europe and build a memorial to those young men, 49 of them from Prince George's County, Maryland, in the shape of a Celtic cross. And by 1925, the American Legion had erected that memorial, dedicated it to those 49 men from Prince George's County, Maryland, who died in World War I. And there's been for almost 100 years now without any problem, until about 5 years ago when someone decided that they were finally offended by its presence because it happened to be on public property. It's in the highway median of a road there in Bladensburg. And so today, in fact, I'm standing on the plaza out front of the Supreme Court this morning, a little bit cold, but this morning we'll be holding arguments before the Supreme Court of the United States to determine whether or not this Veterans Memorial is going to see another 100 years.
So, Jeremy, it's a little hard for people listening right now, some of whom have never been to Washington, D.C. and never actually like physically stood where you're standing. They've certainly never been inside the Supreme Court, and certainly not when a case is actually being heard. Give us a little bit of a window into what that experience is like. I mean, actually, like walk us in there.
Well, if you were here with me, you probably would be warmer than I would. You guys are of a hardier stock than this Texan is, I'm afraid. But it's nice and cool this morning, bright blue sunny sky. But inside the courtroom, people are just now starting to go inside the court building, where at about 10 o'clock this morning, the justices will come out and they will hold an argument. There will be three people arguing on the side of the Bladensburg World War I Veterans Memorial, one on behalf of the state of Maryland. Mike Carvin from Jones Day will be arguing on our behalf, on behalf of the American Legion, at about 10 o'clock this morning. And then the United States of America, its Associate Solicitor General, will be here arguing as well. And the other side will have about 35 minutes to respond to all that. There'll be a lot of questions to be asked, and then, you know, by June we'll have a decision. But this really is the last best place for this memorial. If the Supreme Court does not overturn the decision in the court below, then what I'm afraid is going to happen is not only is this memorial in jeopardy, but so are memorials everywhere a lot like it. And that includes right across the river from where I'm standing in Arlington National Cemetery, where you've got the Argonne Cross, the Canadian Cross of Sacrifice, the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier with its famous inscription on the side about a soldier lying there whose remains are known but to God. If this decision is not overturned, all of those memorials are in jeopardy.
Again, friends, I'm having a conversation with Jeremy Dice. He is the Deputy General Counsel for First Liberty, a host of First Liberty Briefing. And later today, after oral arguments, there's actually going to be a press conference right there on the steps of the Supreme Court to fill people in on what happens. Jeremy, I for one, am certainly going to be praying for Michael Carvin today and others who are making oral arguments in relationship to this. What are some of the arguments that they're making? Like, because I think of this, obviously, as a religious liberty case. Is there more to it than that? Is there a conversation here about what it means to be people who are free to exercise religion in the public square? Like, what, help us understand, you know, for those of us out here on Main Street America, what is really at stake and at issue here?
The biggest thing that's at stake right now is a test called the Lemon Test, and that derives from a case back in 1971 that interpreted the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. And here's basically what's at issue. The other side is saying that because this memorial happens to be in the shape of a cross on public property, the United States, or the state of Maryland in this case, has established a religion in violation of the First Amendment. Now, that's just obviously silly, because this is a veterans memorial that happens to borrow from the gravestones of Europe in its image. But nonetheless, that's the argument. And so what we have asked the court to do, and what we'll be arguing about this morning, is to abandon this test called the Lemon Test. It's led to some very silly results, like having to have enough reindeer near a nativity scene to give it a secular purpose in order for it to be constitutional or something like that on public property, and other very silly results. It's become very unworkable, even if the courts are able to even apply it. And instead, what we've asked them to go back to is, number one, clarify the law. Justice Thomas has said this area of the law is in hopeless disarray, so clearly it needs to be corrected or cleared up. And then as they do so, we want them to go back to a more historic understanding of the law, and a more historic understanding of the First Amendment in particular, that says basically, look, unless the government is coercing you into some sort of religious belief or behavior, there's no violation of the First Amendment. That would preserve not only this memorial, but hundreds of memorials like it across the country.
Hey, we're going to continue this conversation with Jeremy Dyes in just a moment here on Mornings with Carmen. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Mornings with Carmen. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge, continuing my conversation with Jeremy Dyes. He is the Deputy General Counsel for First Liberty, host of the First Liberty Briefing. He's in Washington, D.C. today on the courts of the Supreme Court of the United States, awaiting not only oral arguments in the Bladensburg Memorial Peace Cross case, but also looking forward to a press conference following that. And we certainly are praying for those who are engaged in these oral arguments today in front of the Supreme Court. So, Jeremy, I know that the American Humanist Society is the group who, or Humanist Association, excuse me, American Humanist Association is the group that brought this case. Am I correct in saying that?
That's right. Yep.
Okay. So, at issue for them is that this is the establishment of a religion in Bladensburg, Maryland, contrary to the Establishment Clause of the Constitution. Does it matter that that was not the intent of the construction of the cross in the first place, nor that it's a particularly religious symbol anymore for a lot of people?
Well, look, it's inarguable that it, as a Celtic cross, is a religious symbol, and that's not a problem. We don't have to go around hiding or tearing down memorials or monuments just because they happen to have religious imagery on them, even if they appear on public property. The First Amendment is not offended by that. But because the law has gotten so out of hand and become such a jumbled mess, or as Justice Thomas said again, is in hopeless disarray, we've got courts that are willing to say, like the Fourth Circuit argued below, that perhaps we should remove the horizontal arms of this monument to solve the problem. Well, we can't desecrate a veterans memorial and hope to have a country that is, you know, fond of the things that that we have fought so hard and long to preserve. Instead, we ought to be honoring the way that these mothers chose to remember their sons, 49 men who died defending our freedom. We owe it to them to stand up beside them and preserve this memorial. But this is the results you get when you have case law that has been confusing.
So one of the things that the humanists are arguing is that it's actually it's a military. I mean, it's a war memorial to those who died in service of this country and seeking to advance peace in the world. And yet the humanists are arguing that this is actually contrary to the U.S. military, because after all, the true purpose of the military is to preserve the Constitution. The convoluted arguments that one can get oneself into in terms of defending a position here, I think it's helpful for us, for the lay people out here who are, we're not attorneys. We don't necessarily fully understand the nuances of the constitutional law being argued here. How would you have us pray today?
Well, I would have you pray that the justices would have clarity, and that they would have a good opportunity to ask the right questions. And then, of course, for those that are arguing the case, to be able to present that clearly. You know, I think what you'll hear some of the guys that are arguing the case this morning say is something I think you and I know intuitively as well. It should not take 5 years of litigation, and in this case, a 4-volume appendix, in order for us to determine that a memorial is constitutional. Of course, this Veterans Memorial is constitutional. And I think that, that it's important for us to remember that the only way we remember what has happened in the past is through memorials like this. The gripe of the other side is not with us. It's with those mothers who back in 1919 decided that they would honor their sons, 49 men from Prince George's County, Maryland, with this memorial. Look, I would encourage folks, by the way, to go to our Facebook page today. First Liberty Institute is on Facebook, and we'll be having a couple of Facebook Lives throughout the day today, including at the press conference time around 11 o'clock, 11:30 Eastern time today from the steps of the Supreme Court.
So, Jeremy, I'm just personally interested in, you know, as my brain sort of ranges around this subject, like I imagine that there are like Native American totems on government-owned land. And if any of those were constructed as memorials to war dead, is that similar?
Oh, very much so. In fact, we've been working on cases like this since about 13 years ago now. Back in the Mojave Desert, there was a case out there, another World War One memorial. It happened to be a cross as well. It's the way that we have been honoring our war dead for centuries. You know, look, there were the states filed an amicus brief. Several different states around the country filed an amicus brief pointing to memorials in their states and in their backyards that were similar to this or invoked religious imagery. Again, that's why the stakes here are so stinking high. If this memorial comes down, that would be a travesty in and of itself. But if this memorial were to fall, so would memorials across the country just like it, starting first in Arlington National Cemetery with the two crosses I mentioned earlier there, along with several others that are around those grounds. We cannot allow the memory of these men to be bulldozed, or else we will forget them. I can't help but think of Martha Redmond. She was one of the mothers, the mother of William Redmond, that's remembered by this memorial. She wrote her senator thanking him for his support of this project back in about 1920 or so. And she said, look, I can't go visit my son's grave. Her son was buried in Europe. You can't just hop a plane at the time and go see where her son was buried. She said, I very much consider this memorial to be my son's gravestone. And in talking to the descendants that I've been able to talk to with this memorial, they view it the same way. That is their uncle's gravestone. And if we tear that down, it would be like desecrating a grave. We cannot allow that to happen.
All right, Jeremy, let's leave it right there, and let's invite our listeners to be visiting the First Liberty Institute site on Facebook. So you can find them on Facebook at First Liberty Institute. We're going to be following what's happening today at the Supreme Court in the Bladensburg, Maryland Peace Cross case. Jeremy, thank you for bringing us this update today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Carmen. Appreciate it.
All right, friends, I got to take a quick break, and then we will be back here on Mornings with Carmen. I'm Carmen LaBerge. Welcome back to Mornings with Carmen. I am your host, Carmen LaBerge. All right, I'm going to take what I would describe as a moment of personal privilege here, because, you know, I don't often do that. We don't often just get intensely personal here on Mornings with Carmen. But yesterday was the anniversary of the death of my cousin's husband. So I know that sounds like a stretch there, but her name is Jennifer. His name is Todd. They are the DeKrigers, and they're a little bit younger than me. They moved to Togo in West Africa a number of years ago in order to follow God's leading in their lives to build a hospital for people in the northern part of that country who had literally no access to medical care. They're evangelical Christians. And certainly their heart is the heart is a heart for the people of Togo to know Jesus Christ as Savior and Lord. It's a overwhelmingly, I mean like 99% Muslim country. And because of the grace of God and frankly the spirit of Todd and Jennifer and those whom God drew into this ministry, it was tremendously successful. I mean, they were able to build a functioning hospital in Togo. And it was blessed by the government. The government actually provides them with security, which is pretty amazing. And you'll remember there was an Ebola outbreak a couple of years ago in West Africa. And it was in the midst of that that Todd contracted not Ebola, but another fever-based virus. And because of everything that was going on, he was not air evac'd in time to save his life. And so Todd DeKreiger died. Yesterday was the anniversary of his death. And I just want to lift them up, and I want to lift up other people who are serving Christ around the world today. I want to lift up Jennifer and her boys who continue to labor in Togo. I want to lift up the hospital in Mango. And I want to encourage us to be praying today for people who are on the front lines of the ministry of Jesus Christ in our own neighborhoods and around the world. Missions takes place everywhere that God's people are deployed, and so you're being deployed today into the mission field. You are right now, if you're sitting at a traffic light, if you are dropping kids off at school, if you are headed for a coffee conversation with a friend, whatever it is that you're doing, wherever you are, I want you to look around because that is the mission field into which you are called today to be an ambassador of Jesus Christ, spreading the good news and being a living demonstration of the gospel in the fullness of all of its beauty and truth. You're listening to Mornings with Carmen. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and we'll be right back. Thanks for listening to this podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge from Faith Radio. If you haven't, you can subscribe to automatically receive the podcast through iTunes or the Google Play Music app. That way, you never miss an episode. It's also available anytime at myfaithradio.com.